I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, about the Middle East this time, after the Gaza bloodbath in December. Horror seems to harden hearts, in fact. The 100-to-1 ratio of Palestinian to Israeli deaths, the gross imbalance of forces and weaponry in Gaza, stir rage. But as Meron Benvenisti says in this conversation, the shaming of Israel, even the self-shaming in Israel, stir up defiance, too, and helped elect a new right-wing government of Israel. And still the question comes, how many setbacks does it take to create an opportunity? An opportunity to save the two-state solution from certain death, or maybe to reject it for something else entirely? The conversations here on the sidelines of the Harvard-MIT Gaza conference this week are with two stubborn peaceniks who never give up on their almost opposite ideas. First, Henry Siegman, a pillar of the liberal Jewish establishment in America, who is using a direct channel to President Obama to say, only you, Mr. USA, can make and enforce a fair two-state peace, when clearly Israelis and Palestinians cannot. Then, Mr. Benvenisti, once the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, responds, no, the two peoples will learn to live happily in one state, as they now do unhappily, and the change will most likely come on the Palestinians' initiative. Henry Siegman, it seemed to me you seized the hearts in this Gaza symposium with the clarity and decisiveness of the plan that Paul Volcker has handed to President Obama. It's the plan that Roger Cohen likes an awful lot in the New York Times. It seems to me it's the idea that people took away from this gathering. Spell it out.
Well, this is a group of a bipartisan group of eminent persons. Roger Cohen in his column called them the Mandarins of U.S. foreign policy.
And the good Mandarins.
The good Mandarins.
Scowcroft, right. Chuck Hagel.
Yeah,
Brzezinski.
All the people include, in addition to Brzezinski and Hagel and Scowcroft, Lee Hamilton and Carly Hills, a former trade member of cabinet, Nancy Kassenbaum Baker, Thomas Pickering, Ted Sorensen, and James Wolfensohn of the World Bank. So it's a distinguished group, and there are people who, some of them, James Wolfensohn, is a lifelong supporter of Israel. And yet they all got together and recognized a fundamental truth which they're presenting to the president, which is that without American leadership, and leadership not just for the purpose of facilitating discussion between Israelis and Palestinians, but leadership in presenting the two parties with a framework for an agreement and saying this over time these principles have emerged as the fundamentals of a fair and just agreement, taking certain changes on the ground into consideration. Unless a president is prepared to do that and to treat both sides even-handedly, which is to say that those who refuse to abide by this framework and reject it and therefore want to continue the conflict would be sanctioned even-handedly by the international community. And the U.S. would stop doing what was done during the Bush administration, which is to prevent any Security Council action to help move the peace process forward. This is what they're presenting to the president, have presented to the president, and will presumably continue to engage in public discussion and advocacy in order to get support behind this idea.
Your biggest hope is that the president of the United States would say, enough. Why would he? And what does Gaza have to do with it?
The hope that the president would say enough is because, in fact, most people have come to the conclusion, enough. After 40 years of occupation, of bloodshed, of denying millions of people both their national and individual rights, and on the Israeli side being subjected to Qassam rockets and to terrorist acts, most of the world feels enough is enough, and this should come to an end. And the United States has a very special and unique capacity to assume leadership in this situation, because the Israelis know that their single most important security umbrella by far are not the planes and the armies and the bombs that they are supplied with, but rather America's support and friendship. And if they compromise that, if they alienate an American president, that is something that they can't afford. So the only person who could, at least in theory, do this is an American president. And the hope is that a president who came to power by saying he is open to dialogue, he's open to compromise, he believes that we ought to talk to our enemies and not place conditions to engage in diplomacy, not to try to achieve the end goal of diplomacy by getting the other parties to submit and concede before you even begin the discussion. He is the one person, if he were determined to move in this direction, who could pull it off. So this is why they thought the Obama's coming to office presented an opportunity to advocate this idea.
There were so many objections, in a way, from right and left and Palestinians and Israelis in the conversation today.
Start with the notion that the United States has to become a guarantor of a balance in the Middle East, where in fact it's been the guarantor of the imbalance for so many years.
Exactly. Well, it should become the guarantor of a balance, because the imbalance has hurt all of the parties. It has created, in the view of the people who have signed this document, and I personally agree with it completely, it has created great damage to not just to the Palestinians, who have been totally disenfranchised since the 67 war and living under an oppressive occupation. It has damaged the future of the state of Israel. And in time, if the two-state solution disappears as a viable answer to a compromise solution, then inevitably Israel is going to, it may take time, but in time, Israel will be overshadowed and overtaken by the Palestinian population.
Well, that's the question. I mean, Meron Ben-Vidisti, who everybody thinks is a good guy, said, no, it's an indefensible situation, but not an intolerable one.
He said it's a scrambled egg already. They live all scrambled up, and you can't unscramble them. And the idea of separating them to two separate states is an idea that doesn't exist any longer. It can't be done.
Barry Posen, who calls himself a realist, says it's romantic but wildly unreal to suppose that Barack Obama would take on so explosive a challenge.
Well, I'm not sure that he will. These people are urging him, these foreign policy elites, members of the foreign policy elite, are urging him to do so. But why should he do it? The argument that is being made by these folks to him, why he should do it, because they are saying that while it is true that if there were an Israeli-Palestinian two-state agreement, this would not automatically solve all of America's challenges in the region and in the world, beginning with Iran and with the problems we have with Syria and Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan. This is not, the Israeli-Palestinian agreement is not necessarily the answer to all of those problems. But what they are saying to him is that you will not be able to solve any of those problems unless this conflict is finally ended. Because in that part of the world, all of these folks who are giving us a hard time are exploiting and taking advantage of this Israeli-Palestinian conflict to hurt us and to make the resolution of those conflicts far more difficult. And particularly in the so-called war on terror, the terrorist groups thrive on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. That's what gives them the recruits they're looking for the terrorism. It was described in this document that they handed the president as the Israel-Palestinian conflict. It's the gift that keeps on giving to the terrorists, and that's why it should be ended.
So much depends on your guess about the connectedness of these things.
There are skeptics. There are people on the other side who would say, no, Iran is going to want nuclear weapons regardless, that Afghanistan is going to be close to chaos, that Pakistan is a mess quite unto itself.
That may very well be the case. I have no way of no basis for an argument that Iran, if the Israeli-Palestinian situation is resolved, that will lead Iran to stop its nuclear program. That's quite true. But the point is, they have been able to exploit the Israel-Palestinian situation to destabilize the Sunni Arab world and to gain support in the Arab street all over the region for what they are doing, precisely because the Arab world sees this as an unjust situation and as the Iranians being the only ones who are standing up for the Palestinians and championing their cause.
I've asked a lot of people over the years, if you announce tomorrow that the Arab-Israeli matter was resolved, Jerusalem, refugees, rights, the whole thing, tied up and everybody's happy, what percentage on a scale of, 1 to 100, of the larger confrontation with Islam, with the region, would be settled?
Well, there is no question that if an American president and an American administration is seen as having finally brought a measure of fairness and justice to the resolution of this issue, and Palestinians have a state of their own, and the occupation is ended, that the president's stock is going to go up dramatically in that part of the world. The respect for the United States and its ability, therefore, to conduct a far more successful diplomacy with regard to all of the issues it's dealing with will be dramatically enhanced.
The other objection was raised that it's too late for a two-state solution. This is what my father used to call a horse and rabbit stew. One horse, one rabbit. There's nothing like comparable power or wealth or resources or connectedness in the world between a Palestinian state and Israeli state. It will be inescapably sort of Bantustan. What do you say?
No. If the Palestinian state is a territorially cohesive unit, if it is not fractured into Bantustans, there's no reason. And Palestinians, incidentally, until they got embroiled in the Israel-Palestine war, Palestinians were the professional and intellectual elites of the Arab world. They were managers. They were used in virtually every Arab country to run businesses, to run their academic institutions, and so on. They were described in the region as the Jews of the Middle East, the Arab Jews of the Middle East. So there's every reason to believe that they can succeed if they get their act together. They can succeed in running as a successful and effective state. But that depends on their getting a territorially contiguous country. Not one that is divided into three or four parts, which is basically what former Israeli governments, including the current one, would like to see. That, of course, would not work.
Two more questions. In what way does the awful story of Gaza in December clarify the picture for you, politically or morally or in any other way?
The situation in Gaza doesn't clarify the picture. The intensity of the Israeli assault on Gaza, and also the internal fighting between Hamas on the Palestinian side, between Hamas and Fatah, and their inability to get together to further their own national cause is utterly tragic. Now, one of the reasons they haven't been able to do it is because both Israel and the previous administration have encouraged and provoked this kind of factionalism and internal divisiveness. And they funded and helped train Fatah forces with the express purpose of making war against Hamas and throwing them out of Gaza. So if the occupation ends, or at least if the if a U.S. administration changes American policy, and not only does not oppose a unity government, but helps forge that kind of internal Palestinian unity by providing incentives and encouragement to do that, then there is no reason to doubt that Palestinians are not capable of governing themselves and having a very successful economy.
Who is Henry Sigmund? Where have you been? And how did you come to this very delicately interesting moment?
Well, I have been, I've spent my professional life, most of it, in the American Jewish community. I was the executive head of the American Jewish Congress for 16 years. Before that, they had for 13 years of the Synagogue Council of America. At one point, I was the head of the American Association for Middle East Studies, an academic organization, which is what created my interest in Middle Eastern affairs generally. And I was raised in a Jewishly, religiously observant family, a Zionist family. My father was a leader in the Zionist movement.
Where?
Pardon me?
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in, I was born in Germany. My early years, I grew up in Belgium. Was caught up in the Nazi invasion of Belgium and France, and lived under Nazi occupation and hiding and running and so on for 2 years before somehow miraculously obtaining papers. My parents, of course, obtained papers that enabled them to come to the United States in 1942, in the middle of the war. And that's the only reason that I'm here, and my children and family are here. Otherwise, it would have been end of story. So I have a very intense Jewish background. I had a very intense Zionist background. And it wasn't until after the 67 war that I began to see that this is not as simple a story as I was led to believe, and that there's a whole other side to it.
Meaning, in short?
Meaning that there were the state of Israel, to this day I believe that that there was a good reason for Jews to have a home of their own, but they need to be aware and sensitive to the fact that injustices were done to the Palestinian people in the course of the creation of that Jewish state. And consequently, they have a very special obligation today to see to it that they restore some measure of equity and fairness to the political arrangements they're discussing. Unfortunately, I've seen very little inclination on the part of any recent Israeli government to approach the Palestinians from this perspective.
People of good faith today spoke dismissively of Barack Obama and his AIPAC wish list cabinet and staff. What is your estimate of the readiness among American Jews and the Congress and the new administration to change its course?
Look, one would have to be an incorrigible optimist to believe that this administration is ready to do so. But I think that people who care deeply about the issue and about the equities of the issue have an obligation to try till the very last moment to do it. And American Jews, it's important to distinguish between the American Jewish community and the particular lobbying groups, pro-Israel lobbying groups, who do not necessarily represent the views of American Jews. The interesting thing is that as far as the AIPAC and the other pro-Israel lobbies are concerned, there was never a better president in America for their cause, for their support of Israel, than Bush. And Bush couldn't get more than something like 20% of the Jewish vote. So that tells you something about where the Jewish community is.
I love your spirit, and I hope your plan gets a big hearing and makes some headway. It's important.
It is, and I hope it does, but I think we have to act as if everything is still possible without losing a sense of reality that It just may not be. And we have to think of alternative policies.
But what does that mean? I mean, you're not giving up on your main thrust.
No. I still believe that the only solution that both peoples can live with in the Middle East is the two-state solution. But my concern is that it is disappearing. Its half-life may be no more than 6 months because of the way settlements have been spreading and the infrastructure for the settlements have spread all over the West Bank. So the likelihood that Palestinians and Israelis will be able to resolve the issue, I think, that has already been lost. On their own, they can't do it. The question is it still possible for an American president to muster the political courage to say enough and to tell both parties, this is what needs to be done? And the jury is out on that.
It's a fascinating process to watch and to wait for. Thank you, Henry Siegman.
Thank you for the interview.
Meron Benvenisti is an Israeli writer and teacher who's never accepted the official second-class citizenship for Palestinians in Israel, but he got high marks for running the city government of Arab East Jerusalem in the 1970s.
Meron Benvenisti, what's wrong with the Henry Siegman approach? A strong presidential intervention between two parties that cannot make peace by themselves.
This is the game of answers. What is the situation today? The situation today is that Israel, Palestine, under occupation, under this, under that. I mean, the area from the river to the sea is one entity, one geopolitical entity, masquerading as partially occupied. Therefore, what you have is a binational entity, fully controlled and dominated by one ethnic group, the Jewish. If you accept that, then you have to start thinking, how do you get out of this? From the reality towards some kind of a lofty solution, but not vice versa. That you have a solution and you try to implement it on a totally legendary a reality that you invented.
How did the Gaza bloodbath in December change things? Politically, morally, globally, otherwise?
Well, it changed things. It delegitimized Israel. But on the other hand, what it does, and one must remember that, made the Israeli body politic more cohesive. So Israelis are ready to coalesce when they have external threat. And they perceive the criticism as an external threat. That is why they voted right wing. That is a reaction to the reaction of the world. You make us a pariah, we're going to show you. So what you got is, out of that criticism of Gaza, more than criticism, condemnation of Gaza, you got Bibi Netanyahu and the right-wingers.
Henry Siegman thinks there's at least a workable chance that Barack Obama would take the bait, accept a kind of American trusteeship over a fair solution. Why not?
What can he do? I mean, it's unfair to Obama. You ask him for something he can't do. So why do you ask him to do that? To do what? To force Israelis to, what, give up settlements? There are 500,000 Israelis in settlements. What is a realistic thing that you ask from Obama? You look at Obama as a messiah. Same illusion. You need to say, well, Obama has 8 years, so he'll start doing something. Next year you'll say, he had no time. So what I'm saying is, give up that industry of solutions. Start working. Like, tell the Palestinians, look, you must now start a campaign of one man, one vote. This is what worked in Northern Ireland. This is what worked in South Africa. It will work here. The fact that you think that this is not equal, not identical, you're wrong.
You like the idea of civil rights as a campaign instead of sovereignty. Make the case.
Civil and collective rights within a unitary state, yes. There's no other solution. I'm telling you. I mean, I've been saying that for the last 25 years. I said in 82... It's irreversible. That is how I became notorious. It's irreversible that there will be no physical partition of Palestine, only power sharing. Not vertical partition, only horizontal partition. And now I think I'm vindicated. I mean, that people now accept that. But they say, but now it's Obama. Each time there's another illusion, another Messiah coming. It's the same belief in a Messiah.
Well, the Jews gave us that idea too, right?
Exactly. Yes, yes.
Well, last question. Okay. Can you imagine Barack Obama getting interested in a single state solution?
No. He will continue with this. I mean, there are enough people in that industry that will make him continue with that. And in time, the solution will emerge, or at least the beginning of thinking of a solution, from the people. And I'm sorry to say, from the Palestinians. Because they are the occupied. They are the underdogs. They are the dominated. You can't expect it from the dominant, because the dominant love the status quo. When this will come, I don't know. But it will.
Edward Said's last dream was that it should.
Should? Why not? Yeah, Edward Said, he already expected. He's a prophet of that. Yeah, I agree.
Mayor Benvenisti, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure seeing you.
Okay, let's go.
Paul McCarthy edited these conversations with Henry Siegman and Meron Benvenisti at the Harvard-MIT Conference on Gaza. Please add your own two bits on a two-state or a one-state way in or way out of the impasse at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining in.